and welcome to the Podluck, serving up bite-sized tastes of the best theology. I'm your host, Megan Westra. Grab a plate and let's dig in. We are back. It is the week after Easter in 2020. We are on, at least in our home, we are on a full month today of social distancing or physical distancing, however you want to phrase that. And we are in the middle of our Corona kegger here on the Podluck. So thanks so much again for tuning in. This week, we're going to be talking about a few different things about the way we organize our life together. We're going to talk a little bit about politics and religion. You know, both of those things you're not supposed to talk about. And talking about the scope of perhaps like how far the instructions of Jesus, the commands of Jesus reach, right? Like, is this just about you going to heaven when you die? Is it just about you like getting to be saved for all of eternity? Or are there implications for the here and now? And we touched on some of those things in the first season. If you didn't listen to that, then you can go back, listen to the first season, and you know, check out the thoughts that we talked about on what it means to be saved. That's a great place to start. So if you're like, I don't really know, I haven't really thought about that, go back, listen to season one, and you'll be able to find some more information on what does it mean to be saved. But for this week, I have three episodes I'm really excited to share with you, three different guests talking about kind of the political or like social organization ways that that our walk with Christ should impact the way that we organize our shared lives together. And so I'm super excited to be sharing those with you this week. Today, I'm super excited to be sharing with you my conversation with Dylan Neighbor Cruz. So Dylan is a theologian and a permaculturist, which is super cool. And if you don't know what a permaculturist is, we talked about that at the very beginning because I had like heard that word, but like that line from The Princess Bride, like you keep using that word and I'm not sure you know what it means. Yeah, that was kind of where I was at with permaculture. It was like, I know that word. I'm not going to use it a whole lot because I'm not sure what it means. So we defined that really early on in the conversation. But Dylan lives in Pennsylvania. He's the author of the book Go Golden, Applying a Universal Religious Teaching and the Ethics of Permaculture to Create a Sustainable, Just, and Happier World. So you can check that out. So he talks about ecological sustainability and living in the kingdom of God and how those things relate. He has a master's from Lancaster Theological Seminary and multiple certifications in permaculture design. Very, very fascinating. I enjoyed this conversation immensely and felt inspired afterwards to attempt to live in a little bit more harmony with the land and with my own surroundings. I'm not particularly gifted in that way. As I talked with Dylan, I remembered that I've killed mint twice, and mint is supposed to be like one of those things that you can't kill. Supposedly, I have successfully done it a few times, but I'm trying to think through, especially as we're around the house more these days, like how do I live in a bit more harmony with the natural world around me? So I'm going to roll tape on this and enjoy. So Dylan, I'm wondering, as we talk today, could you begin just by defining what permaculture is so that my listeners understand what you're talking about when you talk about permaculture? And then like how you got introduced to that work, why you became passionate about it. Help us just kind of get grounded a little bit in your story and in your work.
Okay. Yeah, sure. Permaculture is an ecological and social design science that essentially seeks to create ecosystems that are cultivated, but not in the way that modern industrial agricultural systems are cultivated, where in agriculture, as it stands now, it's commodified. Everything is how to get the best price and how to extract the most from the soil or the land. But permaculture seeks to create regenerative systems that provide food, fuel, fiber, meaningful work, connection to the community, and it enhances all life, not just human life. So it's a whole system science. My permaculture teacher trainer, Jude Hobbs, said that it is a system science. So if you look into systems theory, there's a really good primer on that by Donella Meadows. Permaculture is sort of an eco-social systems theory that went from permanent agriculture, that's where the word permaculture comes from, to designing not just agricultural systems or organic food producing systems, but designing everything from social systems to whole city designs. One of my permaculture colleagues is working on designing entire, you know, municipalities using the ethics and principles of permaculture, or at least that was his goal in recent years. So I grew up in rural North Texas, had 3 years of vocational ag when I was in high school. After I got out of the Marines, I started chasing cows for a living, literally on horseback, running around chasing cows. And so I had this agricultural background, but I didn't know anything about organic agriculture or anything. Like, it was all conventional all the way. And then when I was an undergraduate, I took some ecology classes. And then I met somebody who was like interested in the whole idea of sort of an eco-village system. And so we went down together in 2007 to a place called The Farm in Summertown, Tennessee. The farm is really famous for midwifery. Ina May Gaskin was one of the leading proponents of midwifery back from the 70s. They did sort of a back to the land movement. And that was where we studied under Albert Bates, Cliff Davis, and Jennifer English and Matt English. We took our first permaculture design certification course. And it was one of those seminal experiences, completely mind-blowing, and that permaculture helps us to see connections between things that are seemingly disparate. So that's a lot of what my book is about, is looking at the golden rule through a permaculture lens. So whereas in agriculture, like I said before, you know, you're planting this one thing, a monocrop, and you're trying to get all the money you can from the wheat, the strawberries, the lettuce, whatever it is that you're planting, but it's a completely artificial system. And in permaculture design, what we want to create is essentially the Garden of Eden, in which everything connects and cycles back through. So if we look at a healthy ecosystem, which they're harder and harder to find on our planet right now, you will see that there are multiple connections to multiple things, so that, for example, in an old growth forest where there are a lot of mushrooms still growing, there will be mycelial mats. That's the network of fibrous things that connect mushrooms. And when you see the fruiting body, that's just the fruit. There's this big mycelial mat underneath that's doing all kinds of things. And if you read the work of Paul Stamets or see the film Fantastic Fungi, which is about Paul and his work, you will see that this mycelium is not just like holding soil in place. It's communicating with trees and asking that tree, hey, tree dude, what do you need? Oh, well, I need this nutrient. And then it passes along, quite literally, passes along the information through the mycelial net, finds some other tree or some other soil-based organism that has said nutrient, and then sends it back to the tree.
So there's mushrooms this, were so cool. Oh, my gosh.
Yes, right? That's why I call that the real internet. Because... there's something going on there. So when the tree pumps up the water from the ground, and then it transpires into the air, and then it creates more humidity, which creates more rain, which creates more nutrient flow into the system, you start to see this idea of what permaculturists are looking at. So one of the guys who was the originator of the permaculture concept, his name was Bill Mollison, and he was a forester and logger turned academic in Australia. And he was walking around an old growth forest, and he was like, you know, this thing sort of regulates itself with no human input. It's just doing its thing, and it works as it's supposed to. He said, we could design systems like this. And so he started to think about how to work with nature rather than against nature. And how could we come up with highly productive ecosystems that worked in the same way as that forest did? So a lot of your listeners may not be aware, but our planet is a closed ecological system. The biosphere runs from the lowest part of the earth where life happens, so extremophiles in the bottom of the ocean, to the highest place where birds can fly, right? So that's the biosphere. That's the sphere of life on our planet. And we have a closed ecosystem, which is why for the last however many thousands of years, we've had the ability to sustain cultures and civilizations because we've had a relatively stable climate. And everything sort of worked harmoniously together to cycle all those nutrients back. So when the leaves fall and the earthworms and the mycelium and all the other detritivores turn that into humus, and then that allows the trees to be more healthy, then the water cycle happens, and the carbon cycle happens, and the nitrogen cycle happens. The system is stable. And a system is also stable when you have a great deal of diversity of interconnected pieces. So the most stable ecosystems in the world are ones that are highly productive. They're places like estuaries. I live in the Susquehanna River watershed. And at the bottom of that watershed is the Chesapeake Bay. The Chesapeake Bay is an incredibly productive ecosystem that is imperiled because of man-made activities. But that place where freshwater meets saltwater, it creates something called an ecotone, which then creates a niche for different kinds of life. So spreading out from that center of that ecotone, you get these niches of life. And so that's why those places are so incredibly productive. And permaculture designers like myself try to create cultivated ecosystems, to borrow Toby Hemingway's phrase, that are highly productive and yet incredible and also incredibly diverse. So a lot of permaculturists will say you can get more food per acre from a permaculture system, and this is backed up by, you know, data, than you can from a monocrop system. So if you've ever driven through Kansas or Iowa and you've seen all the cornfields and you don't see anything else for a long, long time, that's right. That's an example of a monocrop system that is completely unnatural. It is a synthetic, artificial system. You're going to get a ton of corn from that, but you're not going to get anything else.
Right.
Right. But if you planted all of that in diverse systems, you would get so much more food. You just wouldn't get that one commodity thing. So permaculturists like to stack functions. And when I talk about stacking functions, I use the very humble dandelion as the example. Now, people from Scotts and Roundup, they would like you to kill this very versatile, incredibly important plant for reasons that I cannot fathom.
I always thought they were cute. I have always liked dandelions.
They are incredible. In fact, I just had a little kid out picking dandelions in my 100 square foot little pollinator garden out front. So dandelions are epitomize the the principle of stacking functions, as Bill Mollison described it. So the flowers are one of the first things to flower in the springtime. So it's an incredibly important source of food for bees when it's cold and they can't move well. I'm a photographer, so I can go out and get really excellent close-up shots, macro shots of bees when it's cold out because they don't move. They're doing everything they can to conserve energy. So all those dandelions that come up early are incredible sources of food for them to help them do their pollinator thing, which, as we know now, really need those pollinators.
Yeah.
So the taproot on a dandelion breaks up hard soil, and it oxygenates where it pierces through that hard pan soil. It creates pockets of air where oxygen can get in, and that oxygenates the soil, and that allows life to proliferate more readily in soil. Soil should be teeming with life. Dirt is a dead thing that you find in a field that's been sprayed by a lot of ag chemicals and compacted by big tractors. Soil is a thing that is teeming with life and has billions of organisms in one teaspoon of soil. So when oxygen comes to the party, that helps to foster that life. So that's
so
two.
Deep, deep roots that my grandmother used to be so annoyed with, right? If she was paying me 5 cents per dandelion, and make sure you get it out by the roots.
That's right.
Those roots are actually serving a purpose to break things up and to promote life in the soil.
Yes. And then those roots are also medicinal. So they, if you grind them up, dry them and grind them, they are used as a coffee substitute in times of shortage. I don't think there's any caffeine in them, but you can make a hot beverage out of it. But it's also a diuretic. So if you need to flush your system clean of something, you drink some dandelion root tea, and that will help flush your system out. The leaves are incredibly nutritious. So if you eat young dandelion leaves, always, 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 and only pick them from yards that you know have never been sprayed with Roundup. But young dandelion leaves are full of nutrients. They're more nutrient dense than a lot of the vegetables you're going to find in the grocery store. And they're delicious. So I live in Pennsylvania now, in Lancaster. This is Amish country, Anabaptist country. And they have a recipe where they cook dandelion greens in bacon fat. And let me tell you, that stuff is good. Because unless you're a vegan or a vegetarian, bacon fat is your friend. And, you know, it's delicious. And then you can also, when the time comes that they seed, go to seed, little kids can pick them up and blow them into the wind. And as I mentioned in my book, we could use a lot more of that sort of thing. Mm. Just whimsy, you know, little kids being little kids.
Yeah.
But also propagating this vital resource. Mm. So it brings play into the design. So last year, this little girl kept coming by and she was picking the dandelions. And she was, and I opened the door and I just said, to her mom, I want you to know she can have all of those she wants. That's what they're for. Mm. And she was just delighted. The little girl was so thrilled that she could just come and grab whenever she wanted. She could just come and grab them and just start blowing them into the wind and, you know, having a great time. So permaculture seeks to stack functions like that dandelion. So we're not just typically going to put a plant in because it does one thing or yields one thing. We're going to try to make it do multiple things. So my yard looks a little different than most of the yards on the block. I have a very tiny front yard. It's maybe 100 square feet. But when I did a sort of perfunctory species inventory last year, there were 25 species the day that I counted. Yeah.
Wow.
And that didn't include the spring ephemerals that had come up, done their thing, and then gone back into the ground to wait till next spring. So there's probably 30 to 35 in there. And they're all doing different stuff. And it creates a place where I've seen bumblebees, honeybees, wasps, flies, myriad birds because I also have put a bird feeder out. So there's a lot of life happening just in that little 100 square feet. So it's like, to borrow the line from Field of Dreams, if you design it, they will come. And people come and they ask me, like, doesn't the city say something about your yard? And I'm like, why? It's a cultivated ecosystem. Let me explain this to you. Like, no, this is this way for a reason. You know, I'm doing what I can with the tiny patch of earth that I have to create more diversity, more resilience in the local ecosystem. The underpinnings of permaculture are three ethics. Because I look at them through a theological lens, I say creation care. So care for the creation that God has given us. Neighbor care, because we are called to love our neighbors as ourselves. And future care, because much of what happened in the Bible was thinking about future generations.
Yeah.
And the survival of the group of people associated with the writings. So future care is important. And then there are 12 principles, and those are all outlined in a lot of different places, but there's a very handy chapter in my book, chapter 7, in which I have sort of synthesized them from the theological standpoint, but from the very practical, grounded in the we are human beings that live on earth, and we're called, I think, my reading and understanding of the Gospels in particular, is that we're called to live into the kingdom of God here and now, not wait for some pie in the sky by and by.
Right. Yeah.
That we're, you know, if you read the Gospels, the Sermon on the Mount, if you sit and read the entirety of the Gospel of Luke in one sitting, it's a really mind-blowing exercise. We did that when I was in seminary, and I had never read the Bible that way before. It was always little chunks and memorize these verses, and, you know, use these proof texts for things.
Mm-hmm. It'll change your life if you actually read that thing.
Yes. So when you contextualize things the way that biblical scholars tend to do, with the social historical reading of scripture, then you see that Jesus was really talking about here now, you know, life as it happens on earth, and not near so much about the so-called afterlife.
Right.
He was really deeply focused on making life better for human beings and having human beings live with an ethos of divine love. And where the title of my book is Go Golden. And the idea behind that is, you know, you hear a lot about going green, you know, to help with the environment. Well, if you read Matthew chapter 7, verse 12, Jesus says, in everything that you do, do unto others as you would have them do to you. Well, everything encompasses pretty much everything. So if you think about it in those terms, then how are we living right now in this age of climate change and ecological collapse? Now, as a permaculturist, I am a student of ecology, and I know things that I wish I didn't have in my head about the perilous state that the planet is in right now, and how the leadership globally has chosen in large measure to ignore this in favor of the economy. We can't live into the ethic of in everything if that's our focus, if we're only focused on the economy and making sure that things aren't disrupted. We have to think about the love of neighbor, and that everything then has to include, particularly in this age of climate change and ecological collapse, it has to include a theological ethic of creation care. because I don't care where you live on this planet, you live in a watershed. Mm-hmm. And I guarantee you there's something in your house right now that's poisoning your neighbor's water somewhere far from your house. So when I talk to people about permaculture sort of theologically, I say things like, I'm going to ask you some really important theological questions. What are you having for dinner tonight?
So if I'm having, I can answer these questions because I made dinner this week. Can we do that? And then you can tell me how I'm loving my neighbor or not loving my neighbor by what I'm eating for dinner. We were going to have tacos for dinner tonight, made with red beans. Because I'm a vegetarian, but the other two people in my family are not. And so tacos with red beans and like some locally sourced cheese, because we're in Wisconsin, so there's a lot of that.
Nice.
And some rice on the side. So there's my answer to your theological question.
Yeah. So if the corn or the wheat is not organic, then it is most definitely 100% poisoning people somewhere somehow, because all corn that's not organic is genetically modified. It is mostly genetically modified to do one thing and one thing only, withstand being sprayed with Roundup. Roundup is now being found in women's breast milk and human blood and urine. It has been found by the U.S. Geological Service in every kind of water that they test: rain, lakes, rivers, streams. It's the number one agricultural chemical in the world. And any person with no license whatsoever can go to any big box retailer or, you know, and buy gallons of it and just spray it willy-nilly. And we know now that it's a major carcinogen. So your commodity crops, corn, wheat, soybeans, rice, potatoes in particular, if you can possibly at all afford it, organic is the way, is the ecologically ethical choice to make. The local cheese, awesome. Is it produced with milk that has not been shot up, or cows that haven't been shot up with RBST?
It is.
Excellent. Very good. So see, so you're making, and it's local. You're using beans. Again, better to be organic than not, but lessening the amount of meat consumed is important. It's not important to become vegetarian or vegan. Veganism is a completely unnatural thing. We did not evolve to be vegans. Otherwise, we wouldn't have incisor teeth and all of that sort of thing.
My spouse would be very excited to hear that.
Yeah, it's not a panacea. And in fact, it often supports these monocrop things that are not, that are genetically modified and what have you. Okay, so that's the food one. So my other question is, when you go to clean your house or do your laundry, what are you washing your clothes with, for example?
Right now I'm washing my clothes with whatever laundry detergent I was able to find when I went to the store last week, because it was a little bit of a scramble.
Yes.
Usually I do use something that's got like a, there's some sort of leaf symbol on it, some sort of sustainable biodegradable symbol on it, but I don't really know a whole lot of details about it.
Right. So a lot of people are going out there buying Tide or whatever, you know, whatever the thing is these days. And almost all of those, unless they have an environmental working group A or B rating, are going to be poisoning the watershed. Not only that, their production, just their production, the way they're produced, is going to be creating pollution somewhere, like Dow Chemicals plants or DuPont or whoever's making all that stuff that pollutes watershed. It's a lot of it's going to be a phosphates issue, going into streams. If you see a lot of bubbles and that look like soap. They're not oxygenation bubbles, but like legit soap bubbles. Yep. That's because of phosphates getting into the water. So this is another way that permaculture makes these connections. We think, oh, well, I'm just doing my laundry. Mm-hmm. Well, where does the water go once it leaves the washing machine? Mm-hmm. Well, it goes into the sewer system. And here in Lancaster, the sewer system dumps straight into the Conestoga River. So the Conestoga River, which runs through Lancaster and then into the Susquehanna River, which is one of the oldest rivers on the planet. It has been here since the planet was all one giant continent. Mm. So the Conestoga flows into the Susquehanna. And the last time I looked, the Conestoga had the worst rating that the EPA gives rivers. Wow. Because of all the agricultural runoff here in Lancaster County. We're the number one ag county east of the Mississippi, or at least we were back in the mid-2000s when I took ecology here. And so there's a lot of ag runoff. There's a lot of industrial pollution. And there's, you know, a lot of non-source pollution, like from our homes, from when we're dumping Tide Pods or Cascade for the dishwasher, for example. Or any number of products that have phthalates and fragrances in them that, or phosphates, heavy detergents that are not going to biodegrade. They're going to be watershed pollutants, which again, is all flowing down to our, to my immediate neighbors in the Chesapeake Bay, who now have to be careful about their livelihoods, crabbing, oyster farming, fishing. You know, all of these ecological, what we would call natural capital, is suffering, and human beings are also suffering because of the ill health of the Chesapeake or whatever, the New York, the Long Island Sound, if you go up into New England.
Yeah.
And if, as we've seen here recently, when we stop adding these pollutants to the water, well, the dolphins are coming back into the canals of Venice, and it's only been a little bit of time.
Yeah.
The planet is amazingly resilient, but we keep just adding to the problem. Mm. So that's why things like, what are you eating for dinner tonight? And how are you cleaning your house? How are you doing your laundry? Are deeply theological questions, because if we're not connecting those dots, then we are unwittingly hurting our neighbors. And the unwitting part, you know, that takes some of the onus off, but we've been given bad information about a lot of different things, like the aforementioned Scott's lawn care company. Feed your lawn, feed it. Please stop doing that. That's causing nitrogen overloads. You don't need to feed it, and you definitely don't need to weed it. You know, so don't spray the plantain or the dandelions or the clover. All that's important stuff that creates a cultivated ecosystem or a more natural ecosystem if you just leave it be. The same thing goes for things like, where are we getting our clothes? Mm-hmm. That was, you know, it's really hard to make an ethical decision when you need to buy clothes.
Yeah.
Now, in my day job, I work as a social worker for a nonprofit organization that advocates on behalf of children who've been abused or neglected, and they're in the care of the county. I had to recently go buy professional clothes because I have to go into court in the role that I, as the advocate manager. So I manage these advocates who are all volunteers. And in my role, I have to go to court, which means I have to wear a jacket and tie, yeah, and nice slacks and shoes that, you know, and socks that match and the whole thing. I couldn't go in my typical Dylan permaculture garb of t-shirts that are 15 years old, you know, and jeans that I bought from a company that uses union labor with American grown cotton. Like, that's not going to cut it. So I had to go to the mall. And I guarantee you everything I purchased was made in a sweatshop.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know if you're aware of this, but social work is not lucrative.
I have heard.
I
have heard.
And writing a book, even if it's a really good book, also not lucrative. Just got my first royalty check yesterday. I could take myself out to a nice lunch.
Yep. It's right? A very glamorous life, the life of a writer.
So all that to say, I couldn't get online and search for some company that's going to make me a tailored suit with organic cotton or organic wool and, right, you know, use union labor and all that stuff. Because the economic reality is that Dylan needs multiple things to wear to court.
Right.
And so I have to have shoes and ties and shirts and a couple of jackets. And not one of the things I bought would ordinarily meet my ethical standard of neighbor care in terms of ensuring that these people who are making these clothes are getting a fair living wage and are not being exploited in any way. So new clothes have to be purchased sometimes, and you do the best you can.
Yeah.
But it does create this sort of ethical dilemma in my brain when I have to do that sort of thing, because I have to have a job to eat and live indoors. Mm-hmm. And to do that, I have to support this system that is wrong. And that's why individual choices are, in fact, important, but they're not enough. So we need top down and we need bottom up. So that brings us into the political realm, because a lot of these changes from agriculture to the products that we buy at the store to labor standards, shipping, international trade, all of these things, these are made politically. Mm-hmm. So there's a chapter in Go Golden about politics, in which I make the case that so-called progressive policies are often much more in alignment with the golden rule than other policies. Hmm. For example, my undergraduate degree is in history, so I'm a historian and a theologian. And if you look at, say, the abolition of slavery, the further enslavement of African peoples was a very conservative idea. Mm-hmm. Abolition and full citizenship was a very progressive idea. Just like full universal suffrage. Mm-hmm. If you've seen posters from the suffragette days of what they wanted to do to women who were saying we deserve the right to vote, it was, holy Moses, really disgusting and awful.
Yep.
And definitely not a golden rule thing. Mm-hmm. But allowing women to vote and have some say in these things that affect their personal lives was a progressive idea at the time. Mm-hmm. So in a lot of ways, these things that so many people from where I grew up in the Southern Baptist tradition and in the Church of Christ tradition, two of the most conservative denominations in the United States.
Yep.
And the Southern Baptist Convention was literally created by slaveholders because they broke with the Northern Baptists who were pushing for emancipation and abolition of slavery. Mm-hmm. So it is quite literally slaveholder religion and white supremacist. And that continued and still in some Southern Baptist circles still does continue. Mm-hmm. So you can see how these conservative ideas often fall, in my opinion, on the wrong side of what the golden rule says. And what the other thing that Jesus said was of ultimate importance. And if you look at Luke chapter 10, 25 through 37, you get the parable, what we call the parable of the Good Samaritan. You know, so who's our neighbor? Well, everybody. Because now we live in a globalized world. Of course, his teaching was contextualized to a hyper-local Palestinian context.
Right.
But when we extrapolate that now, because we live in a different context, then all of the people, from Albania to Zimbabwe. Mm-hmm. That's as close to A to Z as I can get, like, running out of countries. They're all our neighbors. And because we live in this biosphere, in which I mentioned earlier is a closed ecosystem, mm-hmm. and now we live with governments that have, whose policies have a great deal of impact on people that do not live between the 48th parallel. So, for example, when Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State, the U.S. State Department worked in cahoots with some capitalist producers in Haiti mm-hmm. against garment industry workers. The garment industry workers wanted their wages raised to something like $2 a day or $2 an hour, right? And the State Department worked to keep it at 31 cents an hour to make like Hanes t-shirts so that they were only paying their garment workers 31 cents an hour. Now, the point, as I say in my book, is not whether or not Hillary Clinton directly rubber stamped this.
Right.
The point is that the system itself created this, where we are being harsh to our neighbors because they're black, they live in a foreign country, and we think that they're less than us, so they don't deserve a wage. I'm not working for 31 cents an hour, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah.
I wouldn't ask anybody I know or any children that I know, because a lot of times in these foreign countries, it's smaller people that are working. To do these things. So why would I say that it's okay to have a State Department that says, hey, let's make sure that we're keeping people in dire poverty so we can get our t-shirts at Walmart cheaper. Mm. So that's why bringing the in everything, I think, includes that political realm. And it means that we can't just sit back and go, oh, these are the issues that I want to vote on. Yeah. So when I was in conservative circles, the issue was abortion, mm-hmm. right? If anybody was for abortion, they were a non-starter as a candidate. You could not right. vote for them.
Right.
Well, that's an important issue. But politicians that use that or gun rights or gay rights or what have you, as wedges. Mm-hmm. These are distractions. Now, all of those things are important. They are individually important, but we can't hone in on that and say, that's where I'm at. I'm a gun owner and I vote, or I'm pro-life and I vote, or I'm pro-choice and I vote. Yes, make that a part of your lens or whatever, but don't hone in on that, because that gives them basically carte blanche to just go off and do all kinds of other things, like make sure that Haitian garment workers get paid 31 cents an hour.
Yeah.
So when we think about things in the political arena, well, is it more in line with the golden rule to say, I think that it's important to pay people a living wage, or to say, oh, but if we do that, it'll hurt the economy. We can look at this in a very hyper particular moment, because just yesterday, the lieutenant governor of Texas said, old people, y'all should go out and not worry about getting the coronavirus. Just die to stimulate the economy. Now, I'm sorry. I don't see anything Jesus-like at all in that line of thought, or in the idea that the current occupant of the White House is going to open us back up to, you know, economic activity to lift all the restrictions, because somebody at the Wall Street Journal said that business is hurting. I'm sorry, putting people's lives at risk so that rich people can stay really rich is not what going golden is all about. It is not living out the golden rule. And so I don't see how a Christian could, in good faith, advocate for something like that. Literally every faith on earth has the golden rule. Mm. And as a permaculturist, we look for patterns. So typically it's patterns of weather or climate or whatever that we're looking for. But as a theologian, that's a spiritual pattern. Even the Satanists have the golden rule. Right? So you wouldn't think that, but they do. And it is core to their belief set.
Yeah.
So if it's in every major faith and many major ethical systems like Confucianism or Taoism,
right,
then whatever God is must think that it's pretty important that humanity know about and do it. And Jesus said it was paramount importance. And the other Jewish teachers who he probably learned that from said it was of paramount importance. And it's in the Torah as important. So, you know, it's a deeply theological thing that I'm talking about. You bring all of these things in and they all, to me, fall under this big overarching umbrella of the golden rule. And all of those things are ecological as well, because they all affect the ecology of the biosphere. If you think about things like the Green New Deal, that's a political decision. The creation of the Environmental Protection Agency was a political thing. Rivers were catching on fire in the United States in the late 60s and early 70s because there was no EPA. And now, you know, there were pictures of pre-Clean Air Act and post-Clean Air Act in New York. And it's completely striking. So warfare is terrible for ecosystems. Terrible. Think about depleted uranium, just the amount of spent brass that we, as we called it in the military, all the chemicals, the petrochemicals that that it takes to get our military to places. The United States military uses so much oil, so much oil that's being burned and creating more pollution, more carbon particulate matter. We're up above 400 parts per million now. So it's deeply ecological to think about matters of war and peace. People can't engage in ecological regenerative farming if they're dodging bombs or if chemical agents are being sprayed on their country. So it all comes down to how do we live into the kingdom on earth, following the teachings of Christ, loving our neighbors as ourselves, while also fostering life on the planet. Because nowhere in Genesis does it say destroy the planet.
Right, right. Dominion. And that's not what rule and subdue mean, is it?
No. And if you read, you know, chapter one, after every step, after every beautiful life thing, the act of creation and the creation story is a vivifying effect on the planet. It is a profusion of life. And at every step of the way, God said, it's good. It's good. It's good. It's good. And it's here for you. So to me, we've done a great disservice as Christians to say that the ecology of this planet is unimportant. And so we have to have this ecological ethic to our theology, because that's the only way, that's an imperative way that we can love our neighbors at this time of ecological collapse. And if people are wondering why I'm using the term ecological collapse, it's because so many global ecosystems are reaching what we call tipping points. And once they reach the tipping point, there's no going back. So we're experiencing massive die-offs in the ocean. That creates feedback loops that then we can't get it back to the stability that created this long period of human history that we've enjoyed a relatively stable climate. So we're putting billions, literally billions of people at risk, and that's not how Jesus wanted it to be. That's not how we live into the kingdom. We do not precipitate the kingdom by destroying the planet. And it doesn't matter what your eschatology is, right? It doesn't matter if you believe in the rapture or don't believe in the rapture. We're called to love our neighbors in our lifetimes, not try to make their life shorter or more miserable so that they could get to heaven quicker. That, you know, or that they should suffer more so that heaven is more glorious. That's, there's nothing like that in there that says that that's what we're supposed to be doing. Not in anything that I've read in scripture, and particularly in the words in red. And that's where that's my fallback. Mm-hmm. If it says something in the Bible somewhere, but I cross-reference it with Jesus and they're two or the never the twain shall meet, then I'm siding with Jesus every time. Mm. And I'm siding with, okay, so how does that fit into the in everything thing and everything that I do? So in systems thinking, it says that if a system is disrupted, that's when the change happens. And the system could be anything from your climate control system in your house. So mm-hmm. if you've got the heat on and all of a sudden you open all the windows, the system is now changed and it can't equalize and you can't get the heat to match, you know, what it's supposed to do. This current horrifically scary, socially disruptive pandemic mm-hmm. has the potential to be so disruptive to our system. It is truly apocalyptic in the sense that apocalypse means an unveiling or revealing. So it is revealing so many things about our systems that are flawed. So from a theological standpoint and from a golden rule standpoint, I hope that what happens is that the system has been disrupted so much that we get to these more equitable places in our political decision-making in terms of who we're protecting and who we're supporting, that we get to, oh, we can mobilize, then we need to tackle climate change. So the political will of the people is that we need a planet to live on and we need it to be more equitable. And yeah, so maybe we've been spending way too many hundreds of billions of dollars on killing people, and maybe we should reallocate that money to up programs of social uplift. Mm-hmm. Martin Luther King said that a nation that spends most of its money on warfare and not on programs of social uplift is approaching spiritual death. And we've been doing that for a very long time.
Yeah.
That's crazy. But maybe this shock to the system will create a level of awareness in people's hearts and minds, because it is a heart and mind issue. Sometimes the conservative, those who are more conservatively theological, are overlooked because they say so much of it's a heart issue, and some of it is. Mm-hmm. But if you overlook the systemic, then it doesn't matter how many parts you change,
right?
Because the systems are going to be in place. So hopefully things like systemic racism and, wealth hoarding and warmongering and the ecological destruction of the planet in favor of short-term profits are all going to be ideas that go away as a result. That's my prayer and hope. Hopefully that there's grace in this and that we fix these things and we start looking at things through a more equitable lens, a much less selfish lens that we have. By and large, particularly people in the West, particularly people in America, we consume so much more resources than the rest of the world. So that's my prayer at this time of really deep fear and disruption, that we come out of it on the other side, living much closer to the kingdom of God.
This has been The Podluck. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I hope that you enjoyed my conversation with Dylan as much as I did. I so appreciated that he both explained permaculture and the way that you can build like a flourishing stacked ecosystem, but also that like for people like me who have killed mint several times, that even the decisions that I make about where I buy my clothes or how much consideration I give to like, do I really need new clothes or what I'm washing those clothes in, things like that, that those also have an impact on the environment. And framing it out as this is a way we love our neighbors, that it's not loving to poison my neighbor's water. So I appreciate the way that he framed it. And this week, as we talk about what does it look like to live as people of resurrection, people on the other side of Jesus's resurrection, right? What does it look like to live as though Jesus is Lord? Because we have the audacity to think that he is. I'm glad to center Dylan's voice first. And so later this week, we'll hear from Caitlin Schess talking about the liturgy of politics, and from Eric Atchison talking about financial systems and justice and equity. So I hope that you will tune in for those as well. Those episodes should be up on Thursday and Friday of this week. Make sure that you've hit the subscribe button so that you don't miss those episodes, because trust me, you will not want to miss them. Also, while you're there, if you're subscribing, go ahead and leave a rating or a review. That helps other people find the Podlock. Again, thanks so much for tuning in. I've been your host, Megan Westra, and this has been the Podlock. Tune us next time with a plate as we dig in again.